So tonight we're opening God's Word to Judges chapter 9. It's a fairly long chapter, so I chose to read the first 24 verses and then kind of jump to the end. We're skipping perhaps a few of the most violent and gory parts of the story. But this is as I said before, it's a discouraging story that we have to really wrestle with. What would God have us see here and know here and learn here and do from this passage, Joshua 9? It's found on page 259 in your Bibles, if you're using one from the bench. I'm using the NIV, if you're using an electronic Bible. So I'm going to read first 1 through 24, and then we'll pause and we'll skip ahead to verse 50. Abimelech, son of Jerubbaal, went to his mother's brothers in Shechem and said to them and all his mother's clan, "Ask all the citizens of Shechem, which is better for you, to have all 70 of Jerubbaal's sons rule over you, or just one man? Remember, I am your flesh and blood." When the brothers repeated all this to the citizens of Shechem, they were inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, "He is our brother. Now he's one of us." They gave him 70 shekels of silver from the temple of Baal-berith. This is the false god they're worshiping at this point. And Abimelech used it to hire reckless adventurers who became his followers. He went to his father's home in Ophrah, and on one stone murdered his 70 brothers, the sons of Jerubbaal. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, escaped by hiding. Then all the citizens of Shechem and Beth Millo gathered beside the great tree at the pillar of Shechem to crown Abimelech king. When Jotham was told about this, he climbed up on the top of Mount Gerizim and shouted to them, "Listen to me, citizens of Shechem, so that God may listen to you. One day the trees went out to anoint a king for themselves. They said to the olive tree, 'Be our king.' But the olive tree answered, 'Should I give up my oil, by which both gods and men are honored, to hold sway over the trees?' Next, the tree said to the fig tree, 'Come to be our king.' But the fig tree replied, 'Should I give up my fruit, so good and sweet, to hold sway over the trees?' Then the tree said to the vine, 'Come and be our king.' But the vine answered, 'Should I give up my wine, which cheers both gods and men, to hold sway over the trees?' Finally, all the trees said to the thorn bush, 'Come and be our king.' The thorn bush said to the trees, 'If you really want to anoint me king over you, come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, then let fire come out of the thorn bush and consume the cedars of Lebanon. Now if you've acted honorably and in good faith when you made Abimelech king, and if you have been fair to Jerubbaal and his family, and if you have treated him as he deserves, and to think that my father fought for you and risked his life to rescue you from the hand of Midian, but today you've revolted against my father's family, murdered his 70 sons on a single stone, and made Abimelech, the son of his slave girl, king over the citizens of Shechem because he's your brother. If then you've acted honorably and in good faith towards Jerubbaal and his family today, may Abimelech be your joy and may you be his too. But if you have not, let fire come out of Abimelech and consume you, citizens of Shechem and Beth Milo, and let fire come out of you, citizens of Shechem and Beth Milo, and consume Abimelech.' Then Jotham fled, escaping to Beer, and he lived there because he was afraid of his brother Abimelech. After Abimelech had governed Israel 3 years, God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the citizens of Shechem, who acted treacherously against Abimelech. God did this in order that the crime against Jerubbaal's 70 sons, the shedding of their blood, might be avenged on their brother Abimelech and on the citizens of Shechem, who helped him murder his brothers. So skipping down to verse 50, in the middle of this passage, essentially Israel gets into a civil war, those who are for and against Abimelech. Judges 9, verse 50 and following, Abimelech went to Thebez and besieged it and captured it. Inside the city, however, was a strong tower to which all the men and women, all the people of the city fled. They locked themselves in and climbed up on the tower roof. Abimelech went to the tower and stormed it, but as he approached the entrance to the tower to set it on fire, a woman dropped an upper millstone on his head and cracked his skull. Hurriedly, he called to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and kill me, so that they can't say a woman killed him." So his servant ran him through and he died. When the Israelites saw that Abimelech was dead, they went home. Thus God repaid the wickedness that Abimelech had done to his father by murdering his 70 brothers. God also made the men of Shechem pay for all their wickedness. The curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal, came on them. After the time of Abimelech, a man of Issachar, Tola, son of Pua, the son of Dadu, rose to save Israel. He lived at Shamir in the hill country of Ephraim. He led Israel 23 years. Then he died and was buried in Shamir. Well, so far through the book of Judges, we have traced Israel's unfaithfulness and God's rescue through what we call the Judges cycle. If you've been with us several of these services, you're familiar with this Judges cycle. We are told that Israel sins against the Lord. They forget who God is, their salvation, his commands. And this leads to God withdrawing his hand of protection. He will not fight for his people against his enemies when his people are acting like his enemies. And so he lets his people be delivered into the hands of their enemies. This leads to oppression, sin and oppression. Israel hits a sort of rock bottom and they cry out to God for mercy and deliverance. And God sends a judge to lead the people to turn back to the Lord spiritually, but also to get up and fight and to take back the land that is their inheritance. And then this is followed by a season of peace. Each time so far, we've seen that the peace lasts as long as the judge is alive. And when the judge passes on, the cycle starts all over again. We've looked at the story of Gideon, and Gideon is this Jerubbaal character that we've read about here in Judges 9. Remember, he's nicknamed that, may Baal be against him, is Gideon's nickname. We've looked at Gideon for 3 weeks. He doesn't fit this cycle exactly. God's people are oppressed by Midian, and when they pray, instead of just sending a judge, first they send a prophet to explain why they're in the trouble they are, the sorry shape that they're in. They've rejected God, and then God calls Gideon to deliver Israel from the Midianites, which he does. Gideon is the military commander that they needed. But Gideon fails to lead Israel to reject their false gods. He sets up a gold statue for the people to worship. Gideon formally rejects the request to be made king, but then he does everything that a king would do. He accumulates treasures and wives. And now in the book, or the beginning of chapter 9, we're told that his 70 sons are essentially his heirs to rule. We're also told that he has one son by a concubine, and he named him Abimelech, which means "my father is king." The close of chapter 8, Gideon has died. Israel once again does evil in the eyes of the Lord. But here in the passage we just read, Judges chapter 9, we don't see Israel go through this cycle. The Judges cycle is stuck. It stopped. this heinous episode of Israel's spiritual history, our history, as part of God's people, they never get beyond sin and oppression. And while most of the time through this cycle, it's oppression by foreign enemies, this time the oppression rises from within their own ranks. Oppression arises when people are simply playing the game of power grabs. Judges 9 is what it looks like for people who persistently forget the Lord, who fail to call upon His name. Judges chapter 9 is what happens when human power struggles are the defining reality of life. People killing one another for more privilege and more influence. Gideon killed men at Peniel for not giving his soldiers bread. Gideon's son Abimelech leads Israel into full-scale civil war. But the passage doesn't just talk about mere human consequences for mere human actions. We're told in a couple key verses that God's judgment is now part of this plot. The just punishment for the bloodshed of those murdered is the bloodshed of the murderer. So Abimelech is the only son mentioned by name in this story. He's Gideon's illegitimate son. That means he's born outside of marriage. Abimelech would not have an inheritance from his father. He's not going to experience this gift of inheritance. And as this story unfolds, it's clear that he believes that whatever he will get out of life, he needs to get it for himself. He needs to be determined to get all that he can. And this is exactly what he does. And no matter what stands in his way, he is going to trample over them to get whatever he can. If you think that this life is all that matters, if you think that getting fame and influence and power is, and then you die, and then that's just the end. If you think that way, then our world will be stuck in a game of power grabs, of conflicts over privilege and influence. As Judges 9 begins, we find ourselves in Shechem. And Shechem is to the nation of Israel as like Gettysburg is to the United States. Shechem is full of history. Shechem is the first place that God appears to Abram when he enters the promised land. Shechem is the first place that Abram builds an altar to the Lord and calls upon the name of the Lord. Shechem is this place that Joshua gathered the whole nation of Israel to worship in Joshua chapter 8. Remember this story of there's two mountains that face each other in Shechem, and they kind of make an amphitheater-like acoustics naturally, so a person can really address the masses before the age of microphones and public announcement systems. Tim Keller says it like this: what happens at Shechem in Judges 9 would be similar to Americans deciding to reinstitute slavery at a meeting in Gettysburg. Israel is in their historical place of their heritage, the faith of their fathers, and they're rejecting, and they're turning away from everything that the Lord has commanded. Abimelech appeals to the people, and he appeals to the people of his hometown. He's a son of Gideon, but he's also one of them. He's one of their brothers, the Shechemites. And his argument is like this: wouldn't it be better to just have one ruler? Wouldn't things go better in the long run? You know, wouldn't it be good to ensure that that ruler is one of us? Choose me as your king. Judges are called by God. Judges are empowered by God. They rise by God's work. Abimelech is the anti-judge. He rises by self-assertion. He gains power by murdering his competition. The people of Shechem fund his campaign to kingship, and he uses those money contributions to hire what are essentially mercenaries, what the NIV translates adventurers. These are warriors for hire who will kill for money. And this band of mercenaries hunts down and kills Gideon's 70 legitimate sons in cold blood. There is a spiritual lesson for our own time here. How do we choose leaders? What kind of qualities are we drawn to and attracted to? You know, although we use the phrase figuratively, I think it speaks loads about our attitude these days. We seem drawn to leaders who, as we say, can destroy their competition. We're often impressed and swayed by character traits that God does not care about at all. God doesn't value popularity and this amazing sense of humor and being an extrovert or always having the perfect comeback. Being able to make people laugh at others in debate. The Lord seeks men who hold to his truth, who lead fairly and in his righteousness, who lead their families, men who are patient, self-controlled. The Lord does not want equivalents of Abimelech in leadership, but he's given us in this country the ability to choose and elect who will kind of head our nation. And then God lets us suffer the consequences for that based on our choices. In Abimelech's murderous rampage to stomp out all competition to his own sovereignty, to his own power, one half-brother escapes. This half-brother is named Jotham. Abimelech, his name means my father is king. Jotham's name means the Lord is perfect. Isn't it interesting how Gideon, in his divided heart, names two different sons these two things? My father is king, the Lord is perfect. So Jotham escapes the clutches of Abimelech's bloodbath, and what does he do? Does he go on a campaign? Does he raise funds himself to hire his own band of soldiers? No, that's not what he does. Does he plot revenge for the rest of his brothers? Like, as long as I have life, I will make sure Abimelech is dead. No, he doesn't do that. What Jotham does is right after the coronation ceremony of ruthless Abimelech, he stands at the top of Mount Gerizim and he tells a story. He tells a fable. He speaks a parable of sorts. Abimelech wins people over with his sword. Jotham is seeking to use words. Jotham tells what I call is the fable of the thornbush king. And his story is designed to show how foolish, how ridiculous they have been to choose to crown Abimelech as king. You know, olive trees, fig trees, vines, these several characters in this fable are valuable plants. They produce crops. They contribute something to the society and to the economy of Israel. They delight. They make glad. They fill stomachs and tables. But each of them passes on becoming king. They would prefer to continue serving what they have to offer instead of have a sway and have an influence over everybody else. Then all the trees say to a thorn bush, come be our king. Thorn bushes don't contribute anything valuable to society. They're short and scraggly. They don't give any shade from the hot sun. They often caught fire in the Old Testament. They would susceptible to fires, and that fire would spread and they would harm the valuable trees around them. Nevertheless, the trees choose the thorn bush, and the thorn bush agrees and even makes this ridiculous offer that in verse 15, this little thorn bush, it's 2 or 3 feet tall, is going to say, I'll give the tree shade. Jotham is being ironic. He's trying to get people to see for themselves how ridiculous this choice is. The thorn bush is somehow going to give you protection. The point he is making, which is laid out here in verses 16 through 20, is this. If you've acted fairly to Gideon's family in making Abimelech king, and let's face it, you haven't, you helped him kill most of his sons, But if you've acted fairly to Gideon's family in making Abimelech king, then may you find great blessing in his rule. But if you've not done right to Gideon, to Jerubbaal, then may you get what you deserve. You'll be burned by him and he will be burned by you. Everything that follows in this story is that burning. Everything that comes after this curse, if you will, of Jotham shows that this is exactly what happens. We didn't read this, but I'm gonna summarize what happens in the thorn bush king when they put confidence in him. The citizens of Shechem, they've already shown that they're prone to switch loyalties at whoever, you know, can offer the better deal. And so they switch loyalty when Gaal, son of Ebed, moves to Shechem and they put their confidence in him. Ironically, he makes the same appeal as Abimelech had, and they just switch loyalties and there breaks out a civil war. Gaal, son of Ebed, worships at the temple of the idol whose funds Abimelech had used, and uses the same argument he has used. Abimelech, unlike the Shechemites, is fiercely loyal to his own cause. His father Gideon had ended up driven to personal vengeance and thirst for the honor he felt he deserved. His son takes the quest to new heights. He fights Gaal, conquers Shechem, and then captures it and kills its people. The place where Abram had worshipped the Lord, where Joshua had all the people worship the Lord, ends up barren, salt scattered over it so its fields cannot even grow again. Verse 45. Over 1,000 Shechemites take refuge in the temple of their idol god, in the stronghold of the tower. But Abimelech's thirst for vengeance is not sated. He leads his men to burn it down. So at the tower of Shechem, about 1,000 men and women also die. It looks as though the tower now of Thebes, which we picked up our reading here, this second tower, will suffer the same fate. But as Abimelech approached the entrance of that tower to set it on fire, a woman drops a millstone on his head. With his fatal injury, Abimelech, ever mindful of his own reputation, has his servant run him through so a woman won't have killed him. In all of this, I think we might ask, where is God? What is God doing in this dark time in Israel's story? We are told in a couple key verses 23 and 24, and then it's verse 56 and 57, that God is active behind the scenes and carrying out judgment against this wickedness. If this wickedness is left unchecked, if this is all that the world comes to be, then you and I would all be in miserable shape. We'd be in miserable societies, living miserable lives, wondering who is going to win the Game of Thrones next and who's going to suffer and get killed in the wake. God says, or we are told here in verse 23 and 24, that God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the citizens of Shechem. He made sure peace and this alliance would crumble. It was God's act of mercy to start destroying and unraveling this horrible kingdom that Abimelech was building. After all was said and done, verses 56 and 57 tell us that God repays the wickedness of Abimelech that Abimelech had done to his father by murdering his 70 brothers. God also made the men of Shechem pay for all their wickedness. The curse of Jotham, son of Gideon, came on them. God may have been silent, but he was not absent. In what seemed like a natural course of events, just a bunch of men fighting over privileges and the right to rule. God is acting in judgment. There are no lightning bolts from heaven. There are no clear hailstones or fire of judgment, but there is justice. Romans chapter 1, verse 18 tells us that the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the ungodliness and all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. God's judgment is not only reserved for a future day. Sometimes it breaks into present reality and breaks down the forces of evil that are being built up against all the goodness that God has created in this world. There are a few things we can learn about God's judgment here. And when God's judgment comes into time, our own time. First of all, it comes unseen. It's not easy to pick out where God's judgment is occurring here. The people at the time could not have seen the Spirit of God sent to use the evil in Shechemite hearts for his just purposes. In our own day, we have no divinely inspired narrator to lift the curtain to tell us where and when and how God is judging people. Some people have asked, I had a conversation with someone recently, you know, this tornado happens, this earthquake happens, is God's judgment part of that? And the answer that we have to give is that we're not sure. We don't know. It's possible, but we don't have the authority, we don't have the word from God to say that that exactly particular instance is. Now, there are people in our world who think that God cannot ever act that way, that God would never punish anybody for wickedness. And they don't think the God of the Bible is still the God that acts today sometimes in judgment to bring justice. But there are others who ought to be cautioned that claim that God, you know, speaks to them, and they get on television and they say, well, this hurricane took this path because it avoided a whole bunch of righteous people here and destroyed a whole bunch of wicked neighborhoods there. And I don't believe the people that say these things are hearing from God. As Jesus told the parable of the wheat and the tares, God's judgment is being withheld when there are righteous and wicked people living in the same communities. God is judging people for particular sins, yes, but it's unseen. It perhaps is only in hindsight. Here in Judges 9, it seems pretty obvious. We've got a whole community, a whole society that's turned against the Lord. Second of all, God's judgment comes after a wait. We are told in verse 22 that Abimelech governs Israel for 3 years before the spirit of discord starts ruining things for Abimelech's plans. 3 years after Jotham tells his story, the things start to fall apart. 3 years of waiting must have seemed like an eternity to Jotham, who spoke out of his faith, and they just had to learn patience and trust. God's going to do something. I've done what I can do. God will do the rest. God's judgment comes through the outworking of human sin. Shechem was destroyed because of its disloyalty. Its greatest sin was its downfall. Abimelech was destroyed because of his desire to maintain position at any human cost. He had no need to attack Thebez. His greatest sin was also his downfall. God, in his judgment, uses the tools of human rebellion against those who rebel. We bring it on ourselves, but God uses what we bring on ourselves to bring his judgment through it. Well, after this episode, the judge's cycle resumes. It stops at sin and oppression. But nobody calls upon the name of the Lord. In fact, God doesn't hear a particular prayer go up and offer for a respite, for deliverance from this horrible episode. We skip the phase of prayer, and God, in sheer grace, after all of this criminal activity is over, Judges 10, verse 1, God sends a new judge, Tola, to deliver and save Israel. He lives in Shamir, the hill country of Ephraim. He leads Israel 23 years. The rule of Abimelech has plunged Israel into new depths, and yet there is still more to come. There still is an after the time of Abimelech in their life. This is the same language used of previous judges. God raises them up to save Israel, to lead them back to the ways of the Lord. And he is followed by another 22 years of peace under Jair following this. This is the sheer grace of God. People have completely abandoned the Lord. They have opted to be led by a man who is chosen not by God, but by himself, who is recommended not by the Lord's divine command, but by his own power. Israel has sunk the depths, and they're not even crying out in repentance. And God sends a judge. God sends rescue. Judge saviors, even when they're not asking for them. But unlike the earlier non-cycle judge, Tola, what did Tola rise to save Israel from? Well, that's what chapter 9 was all about. Tola saved Israel from itself. God's people ultimately need a leader who will rescue us, not simply from our enemies out there, but often from the enemies within us. Rescue us from our own failings and ambitions of our own hearts, from the divisions and strife among us. It's a great reminder that the church's greatest problem sometimes can be the church. And when we see churches with godly, humble leadership, with gospel-centered unity, which enjoy and pursue and share peace with justice and love, we, unlike Gideon and Abimelech, must give thanks that God who has, in his grace, given us a spirit to transform our hearts and restore our relationships. We are not self-made people. When we try to be self-made people, Judges chapter 9 happens. The fact that we are not in this situation, that we take it for granted that when we enjoy relative peace and civil discourse and dialogue in our land, we take it for granted. It's not the norm for people who are just pursuing their own self-interest. The norm is Judges 9. The reason why we are enjoying the time and the season that we're enjoying, as bad as the world is, when we see the things that the world is up to, we still are kept in God's hand. We're given a beautiful place to live, this freedom to worship here. We're given all these things as God's gracious gifts, and we ought to not take them for granted. And I think a passage like Judges 9 wakes us up to the reality of what we really have, because it recalls what human beings are capable of when they're not led and they're not governed by the Lord of the universe. So let's thank and praise him for the grace of humble leadership, of peace, of reconciliation, of people who don't have to one-up each other and are not grasping for power. If we're serving one another in this community, it's because the Lord's Spirit has worked here and worked among us and shaped us to be his people.